Welcome to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. It's been said you need to know where you've been to know where you're going. That's especially true when it comes to the Earth's ecosystems. Researchers are unearthing deep sea sediment containing important information about past climate scenarios and what it could mean for the future. Elizabeth Griffith is a professor in the School of Earth Sciences at Ohio State University. She's an isotope geochemist and a paleoceanographer. Welcome to All Sides, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Amy, for having me.
So I read in your bio that you're interested in the Earth's past as its key to understanding our future. But to help us understand what you study, let's start with those titles that I just said. Tell us what an isotope geochemist is and then a paleoceanographer.
Sure. I am a chemist. Well, I'm a geologist, a trained geologist who uses chemistry to uncover secrets in the sediment or in the dirt, in the oceans. So the measurements that I make are on measuring isotopes, which are just different types of atoms of the same element. And it uncovers these secrets in the sediment that we're looking at. And the type of sediment I look at are in the oceans. So these are ancient oceans, so paleoceanography, so studying those ancient ocean sediments.
Okay. Why do you think exploring the deep ocean floor is so important?
Well, as we look, as you mentioned, as we look into the future, we are trying to understand how things might change as conditions on Earth change. And as humans, we've only really experienced the more recent past on our planet. And so in order to really look at conditions that were very different from today and in the most recent past, we really have to look into the geologic record. And ocean sediments provide this for the past 100 million years. We have a really nice record of what conditions were like in the oceans and on Earth in the past.
Now, you said you were a chemist, then you became a geochemist. What drove you to this particular area of expertise? Where you combined geo and chemist and oceanography and all of that together? How did you find yourself in this niche?
Well, as a kid, I was kind of interested in fossils. I got to go on a fossil dig in Nebraska. Being from the Midwest, that was close to home. And I kind of was excited about uncovering secrets in Earth's past. And as I learned more at the university, I was drawn to the oceans and the sediments and the microfossils, so tiny fossils that we can uncover in those ocean sediments and what that tells about our planet.
So what sort of technology do you use to explore the deep depths of the ocean? Because my understanding is it's really hard to reach down there.
Yeah. For the past few decades, we've been using expedition vessels, so boats, really large boats that have really high technology that can drill and recover those sediments in very deep water. So the first thing you need to do is be able to recover those sediments, so bring them up so that you can study them. It's not like working on land where you can drive along a highway and see a pile of rock that you can just sample like that. So these particular sediments, we need that advanced technology. I mean, we're talking about ocean depths that are a couple miles deep, right? We have to get to the sediment through about 2 miles of ocean water before we can start to recover the sediment in the oceans.
Are the machines that are able to do this relatively new? Because I'm just thinking about how long it took for us to actually get a camera to the Titanic. And I just, you know, like that's my frame of reference. So is this relatively new, being able to actually get that deep and do something with it?
Well, some of the first expeditions were a couple, you know, a few centuries ago, but they were just kind of grabbing whatever they could recover. Mm-hmm. So just literally putting kind of bucket system, you know, to go down and grab whatever sediments that could be recovered. The more sophisticated technology has been developed over the past 50 years, the last five decades, And it keeps improving as we learn, how to recover the sediment better and in deeper waters as well. So, yeah, fairly recently in the last 50 years, but really have improved. Those first sediment cores that were recovered, even with the ocean drilling technology, were just sort of pieces or biscuits and not a continuous sedimentary sequence that we can look at.
Are you looking at any ocean in particular, or all the oceans? Have you done all the oceans?
I focused a lot of work in the Pacific, and most recently really worked with an international group to kind of talk about what more we can do in the Pacific Ocean. In particular, the tropics has been an area that I've been interested in, where the waters are productive, producing organic material, which feeds ecosystems in the open ocean, and also sequester carbon from the atmosphere in this region. I've done some work in the Atlantic as well, but not the Arctic or the Southern Ocean. Haven't made it there.
Do you go out on the boats for the retrieval, or do you just study what they bring back to
I would love to go out
you?
more. I've only had the opportunity to go on 1 2-month long ocean drilling expedition. This was actually in the Arabian Sea, and it was fantastic.
I guess I was thinking oceans, but you could drill in the sea too. Is it are seas just as deep as oceans? You're exposing my lack of water knowledge, but go ahead.
Yeah, we often that's a great question. So we often talk about the different ocean basins and think about the Pacific as being separate from the Atlantic or the Southern Ocean, but really they're all connected in one global ocean. So yeah, the Arabian Sea is just a name for the water body that's on the western side of the Indian Peninsula, the country of India. But what was I saying? Yes, it's deep. It's very deep. Yeah, we were using the same technology that we drill in the Pacific to drill there.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about what ancient sediment in the sea can reveal about the Earth's history with Elizabeth Griffith, a professor in the School of Earth Sciences at Ohio State University. So, can you tell me about your most recent research project? Where was the sample from? What's the subject? What are you working on right now?
Well, right now I have a PhD student who's working on samples both in the Pacific and the Atlantic to compare what's happening in the two ocean basins over this early Miocene time period, which is what geologists call about 21 to 17 million years ago, right? So sounds like a long time ago, but it's in Earth history that's fairly recent. And there's a paper that came out that recorded a shark extinction in the Pacific. But there isn't a lot of data to understand why there was a shark extinction. So we are trying to uncover more information about beyond just the sharks, but more of the ecosystem in the Pacific as well as the Atlantic to understand what might have driven the shark extinction.
So you learned from the sediment that you've pulled up from the ocean, you learned that there used to be a species of shark that's not around anymore. Is that what you mean?
Several,
Oh,
yeah.
sev oh several.
I have to look at the numbers, but I'm recalling about 90%. It was a very unusual finding by some researchers.
So what else can this sediment tell us about our past? I mean, you're trying to figure out why the sharks went extinct. We don't know that yet, but what else can you learn from the sediment about the past?
Well, I mean, we can discuss, the temperatures, the conditions within the ocean. So the surface of the ocean water is at different latitudes. So as you move away from the equator, how temperature has changed. We can tell about the atmospheric composition. There's certain the chemistry of some of the fossils respond or change based on some of the carbon dioxide content in the atmosphere. So we can our best guess at what the atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations were at fairly high resolution. So we're changing climate fairly rapidly in the geologic record, which is really important.
How has climate change contributed to or changed your research in recent years? Are you discovering more about the climate by studying the deep ocean?
Yes, absolutely. Time scales can be a little bit different if we're talking about changes that happen on a seasonal or annual basis. I've been focused in my studies more on longer time scales, so things that happen over thousands to hundreds of thousands of years, and how external factors like so incoming solar radiation, how that impacts the climate system on Earth, as well as volcanic activity and kind of feedbacks in the system.
So, me saying something like the temperature of the ocean has increased in the past 50 years, or more glaciers are melting in the past decade, that's just like a tiny, tiny blip in the thousands of millions of years that you're studying, right?
Absolutely. But it all contributes to the record and how the Earth is evolving.
Yeah. So, can you tell if we've experienced a climate crisis, like 17 million years ago, by looking at the ocean floor?
We have some really good clues. Some, collectively, the community talks about this time period, as you mentioned, about 17 million years ago, as being the past, what do they call it? The future of the past. So thinking about it as an analog for future climate conditions.
Now, you mentioned all of these different species of shark that are gone that you've discovered. In your opinion, what's another interesting or really important discovery that you've made?
That's a great question. I have studied another time period where we had the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, so 55 million years ago, so still after the dinosaurs have gone extinct. But at this time period, we had a large increase in temperatures, we think due to an increase in carbon in the Earth system. And one of the things that was interesting is in studying the sediments, we found that we think the changes in temperature in the middle of the ocean is very important to driving the carbon cycle dynamics within the entire water column. So if the surface is warming, that's important, but those intermediate waters, so below the surface of the ocean, can influence how carbon is sequestered in the ocean. So we need to understand temperatures throughout the water column, not just at the surface, which is relatively easy to capture in some of the sediments, but also in the deeper ocean. So for me, that was really interesting.
Can you tell what the temperature of the water was from studying sediment from millions of years ago?
We have some good ideas. Yeah, we have some what chemical tracers we call them. They're sort of a proxy. They change with temperature, so we have a good idea of how things have changed
Okay.
at one site, right, in one core. We'd like a lot more data.
Have you found, besides all of the extinct sharks, have you found other things that used to exist that aren't here anymore? I guess besides dinosaurs, maybe.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to think. That's of a very specific example. I don't know.
That's okay. We can talk about the shark. We can talk about the sharks more. We have a
I'm just learning.
Yeah. So
Great.
basically you drilled down and you're finding fossils of old sharks, right, that don't exist anymore. Is that what you mean?
The pieces of sharks. So
Pieces of
there's,
sharks. Okay. And you're able to just like study and piece it together. Do you even know what they would have looked like, or is it just all speculation?
So this is work that I don't do directly, right? I collaborate with a researcher who's now at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, and so she is our shark expert.
Okay.
And so I think she has a picture in her head.
I'll do another show on the sharks. Okay.
You
So just
should.
as a final question, where do we go from here? Like, what's your next step in the potential future conditions of the Earth that you can figure out from your research? What are you going to do next?
Well, what I'd really like to do is advocate for drilling more and recovering more sediment in the Pacific. It's the largest ocean basin. It's the deepest. It holds a lot of heat, the most amount of heat and carbon. And we really have just begun to explore the Pacific Ocean. So just putting in the work to do and collect more sediment and study it. I think I mentioned, you know, a lot of the deep sea drilling just barely recovered sediment from some of these really exciting locations. And we just need to go back and drill and recover more sediment to study.
All right.
More locations.
We've been talking with Elizabeth Griffith, a professor in the School of Earth Sciences at Ohio State University. Thank you so much for your time today, Elizabeth.
I appreciate it. Thanks. Thank you, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk about the latest business venture from the Trump family, a mobile wireless service. That is when All Sides continues with Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jarovich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. The list of Trump family businesses, which have had a varying degree of success, include hotels, steaks, and a university. Now we'll add to the list a wireless company. Move over Verizon, Trump Mobile is here. Shira Ovide, it writes the Tech Friend newsletter for The Washington Post. She recently tested the Trump mobile wireless service, and she joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Shira.
Thanks for having me.
So you personally tested out the new Trump phone plan. Were there any immediate features of it that you noticed that were different from a standard phone plan that we'd all be used to?
I would say no. It's not that different. The Trump mobile service does promise these kind of add-on features, including things like roadside assistance and telemedicine services. It's not clear that those are actually functional yet, so stay tuned on that. I did not test those extraneous services, but basically, it's phone service.
And is the Trump phone plan fully functional? I mean, I know you tested it out. It seemed to like pop up out of nowhere all of a sudden. Did it work right away?
It definitely did not work right away. I had a really frustrating experience when the company first announced this Trump mobile service where I signed up online. My credit card was charged $60-something for the service plus taxes or tax-like fees. And then nothing happened for days and days. And I contacted customer service by phone and email. And basically, it seemed either because there was overwhelming demand or because this wasn't a very well-run mobile phone company out of the gate that I actually couldn't use the service that I signed up for the first three-ish days.
Mm. And then after those three-ish days, once you got it figured out, you did get it working though, right?
Yes. After those three-ish days, Trump Mobile, I installed it as a secondary option on my iPhone. And it worked pretty well, which I think shows that if the Trump family business can relatively successfully operate mobile phone service, then what are we paying, you know, these exorbitant fees to kind of Verizon and T-Mobile and AT&T? Why are we doing that when you can get these lower cost kind of smaller company services from Trump Mobile or from many other providers with a longer track record?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm a Verizon customer. So just to explain to me how this would work, I could keep my same phone and drop having Verizon, but and then just like start using the Trump phone plan the same way I would if I wanted to switch to Mint Mobile or something like that.
That's right. Yes. And you don't, in some cases, you don't even need to drop your existing mobile phone service because more and more of our smartphones have these features that are called eSIMs, right? Which is basically a digital virtual way for our phones to communicate with mobile phone providers. You can use your existing Verizon or whatever service alongside these smaller phone providers like Trump Mobile, like Consumer Cellular, like Mint Mobile, Ting. Try them side by side, basically, and just turn one off for a while, try it out, turn on Verizon, and give yourself a sense of how they perform essentially side by side on your phone.
And the reason I would want to do that side by side would it be to make sure if an untested phone company, make sure it works in my house and in my office.
That's right. And it's not just an untested phone company. I mean, I think the issue is that it's really, really hard to know for anybody who's ever looked at sort of those coverage maps mm-hmm. online of Verizon versus T-Mobile versus AT&T. It's almost impossible to look at those coverage maps and learn what you actually want to know, which is the best phone provider for where I live or where I go to work or where I visit family, right? And the best way to figure that out is to actually put that mobile service on your phone and try it out. And again, that's getting increasingly easy to do. And I'm trying to encourage more people to try these alternative phone providers that generally offer the same network quality of AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile, but for far lower costs.
So besides the lower cost, are there any other pros of picking up the Trump Mobile plan?
Okay, so the Trump Mobile plan, look, I think the people who are signing up for Trump Mobile, besides me, who just trying this for journalism, they're probably people who are fans of Donald Trump and want to signal their support or, you know, pay him money. So, you know, I can't say that Trump Mobile is better or worse than these other smaller phone providers like US Mobile or Consumer Cellular or Mint that have been around a long time. I will say that Trump Mobile is on the expensive side for those kind of smaller phone providers. You know, again, with these taxes or kind of tax-like fees, it's in the 60-something dollar range. I am currently using service from one of the cable providers, Spectrum, that offers service to their home internet customers. And that retails for relatively comparable service, about $30 a month, including taxes. So, you know, it's less than half the cost of Trump Mobile.
But if Trump Mobile is, you know, roughly $60-ish a month, so that's more expensive than some of the other smaller companies, but that's still less than Verizon, I have to say. And
yes,
I'm not being
anecdotal
here. I know that's less than Verizon. Yeah.
It is. It is. Yes. On average, Verizon customers are paying more than that per month. And you know, I think it again goes to show you that when you have service from the three large phone providers, right? You know, you're paying a lot of money and there are advantages that come along with that, right? They have very robust in-store or on-the-phone customer service help. You know, they have a long track record, but you're also paying for, you know, they spend a lot of money on marketing and that is reflected in your phone bill. I think that you have to question, are you getting what you pay for with the larger established phone providers?
This is All Sides and Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about Trump's mobile wireless service with Shira Ovadeh, who writes for the Tech Friend newsletter for The Washington Post. Now, Trump Mobile has also promised a smartphone, which it's a gold phone, very flashy. Where are we at in actually having the Trump-specific phone to go with the phone plan?
Yeah, great question. I have no idea. Mm-hmm. And you're right, when Trump Mobile announced its new wireless company, one of the things they said is they promised soon they're going to have this $499 what they said at the time was a made in the USA smartphone. And I think everyone seized on that immediately as basically an impossible mirage, that we know from experience how that there's almost no smartphones being made in the United States right now. They're largely made in China or in Vietnam or in other countries that have over the last decade basically become these manufacturing hubs for electronics. And nobody believed it was actually possible for Trump Mobile to deliver a made in the USA $499 smartphone. And indeed, Trump Mobile seems to have backtracked on the timing of the smartphone, whether it would be made in the USA or kind of put together in the USA. So I would say let's wait and see in a couple months if there's actually a Trump Mobile smartphone and if it actually delivers on the price and manufacturing location that they initially promised.
Yeah, I wonder if people switched to Mint Mobile thinking that they were going to get the gold phone right away. Do you think that that was kind of a part that was not understood completely?
Yeah, it's a good point. And you're right, Trump Mobile kind of talked about these as a package deal, right? Mm-hmm. The phone plus the wireless service. And, you know, that is generally how we buy smartphones, right? We mm-hmm. buy smartphones and phone service together from our wireless provider. So it's possible, you're right, that people signed up for mobile service initially kind of expecting to get the Trump Mobile phone down the line as well. Let's see what happens. I'm very curious to see if what Trump Mobile actually delivers in their mm-hmm. in their promised smartphone.
Is there any way of knowing this is, I mean, it hasn't been out for a long time, but it's been out for a couple of weeks. Is there any way of knowing how many people have signed up for Trump Mobile, or is that because it's a private company? We don't really know.
They haven't told me the numbers. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine. I don't know what the numbers are. Let's put it that way. And you're right. It's probably true that they won't disclose them, or if they do disclose them, you know, we probably need to dig into the numbers a little bit to see if it's true. So it's not going to be the world's most popular wireless service out of the gate. Let's put it that way.
So you tested it out. You wrote a few stories about it. You have the TechFriend newsletter. Did you get any comments or emails or contact from people who have the service? Did you hear just anecdotally from others about their experience?
I heard from no other Trump Mobile customers, which I don't know, maybe is telling or maybe is meaningless. And you know, I think some of the feedback I heard was basically about the long-term usage, right? That wireless providers and all wireless providers have not always proven worthy stewards of our personal information. There have been, you know, constant data breaches, notably to T-Mobile customers, but definitely not exclusively T-Mobile. Other large providers have had similar issues. And I got some feedback saying, do you really think Trump Mobile, given, you know, that they're small and kind of sprung up out of nowhere, are they really going to be good stewards of our, you know, sensitive personal information, including, you know, your cell phone provider might keep records of literally everywhere you go with your phone, right? They can mm-hmm. tell when your phone kind of connects to a local cell phone tower where you are in the world. And that's pretty sensitive data. So it's worth thinking about whether you trust your wireless phone provider with that kind of information.
Do you feel like maybe the whole Trump Mobile idea will grow in popularity once the gold phone is available?
I assume that's their bet, right? Mm-hmm. If they can deliver a kind of useful, cool-looking, affordable phone, a package together with wireless service, that they can get some customers, right? And we know from the big wireless providers that it's pretty profitable to run a wireless service company. So, you know, they might generate a lot of income and profits from running a wireless service, even if it doesn't get hundreds of millions of customers.
That was my next question. Why is the Trump family getting into the mobile phone business?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. And, you know, they've made, you know, they've also talked about the trying to prove that you can actually make phones in the United States and things like that. But mm-hmm. I think the real reason is it's profitable, right? That, again, assuming you're a good quality wireless service provider and people don't ditch you, you know, half your customer base doesn't ditch you every month. So you're kind of constantly hunting for new customers. Mm-hmm. If customers like you and stick with the wireless provider, it's a pretty profitable business in the United States. And, you know, that's pretty appealing to a lot of people. And you can see that because there are a growing number of these smaller companies that are doing what Trump Mobile is doing, which is basically paying to lease networks from Verizon, T-Mobile, and AT&T and reselling that as their own wireless service.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you are an advocate for telling people to be willing to try out some of the smaller companies. So are you basically saying, you know, even though Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile have the majority, you think it's worth people giving these other companies a try?
Yes, I cannot shut up about this, actually, that I think everyone in the United States should at least try one of these smaller wireless providers. And you can go look, Consumer Reports has a really helpful guide to trying and buying smaller wireless service providers like Mint Mobile, like Consumer Cellular, like US Mobile. And again, in the Consumer Reports rankings of their own member satisfaction, the top rated companies by customer satisfaction are these smaller phone providers, right? Like Mint, like Ting, like US Mobile. And that tells you something, right? That the traditional phone providers are at or near the bottom of that list of satisfied Consumer Reports members, and the smaller companies are at or near the top. So I think that's meaningful.
Do you have to live in a city for some of these smaller companies to work for you? What's their coverage like?
Yeah, you don't have to live in a city. Again, it's worth trying them out before you make a commitment, right? And as I said, if you have a phone that has this eSIM feature, you can, without quitting your existing wireless service provider, pay to try for a while another one alongside to see if it works where you live. And again, because these smaller phone providers are leasing or renting the networks of the big three wireless carriers, generally you can find one that works almost the same as AT&T because it's using the AT&T network, or works almost the same as T-Mobile because it's using the T-Mobile network.
How do I know if I have an eSIM phone? Is that a silly question? I don't know.
It's definitely not a silly question. If you have an iPhone that was a model released since, I believe, 2018, then you have an eSIM. If you have a Samsung or another phone, probably your best bet is to, you know, type it into a web search like eSIM, Samsung Galaxy, whatever your model number is. Mm-hmm. You can also, if you're comfortable kind of searching in your phone settings, you may be able to get a sense that way. And lastly, again, this is maybe too much information for folks, but traditional phones, that have a conventional SIM, a physical SIM. If you have there's a little slot in the side of your phone that has a little tiny hole that you can poke at with a paperclip, basically, and it slides out a tiny slot with a tiny piece of plastic that's basically the SIM card that communicates with your wireless network. If you don't have one of those tiny little trays in your phone, then your phone uses an eSIM.
Okay. Got it. Well, just to end, simply put, would you recommend Trump Mobile to others to try out?
I would not recommend Trump Mobile unless, again, you want to support President Trump or his family business, right? I think this is kind of a mobile service for fans of President Trump or his family business. But I would encourage more people to try out other phone providers other than Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile.
Our guest has been Shira Ovadeh, who writes the Tech Friend newsletter for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for joining us today on Tech Tuesday.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk about how you don't have to book your flight anymore. You can let AI do it. That's when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Tech Tuesday, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Booking flights has gotten more expensive and more complicated over the years, which leaves many hunting for occasional price adjustments, mistakes, or last-minute fare discounts, which sounds like the perfect landscape for AI to navigate for you. With people trying out a multitude of AI resources to find the perfect flight, are they working, or is it just another dud in AI's development process? Joining us to discuss is Russell Holly, the Director of Commerce Content for CNET. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
So how does AI book your flight? Do I want it to do that?
Well, probably not, at least not yet. It turns out that finding the best price to book a flight is hard, no matter if you are a human or not. And doing so just requires jumping through a lot of, jump through a lot of hoops that AI has not yet learned how to do. So for example, one of the tests that we performed over the last couple of weeks was identifying coupons that could be added to specific flights, because you can search anywhere online and find a bunch of coupons, but making sure that they actually work for the thing that you're trying to do is the challenge more often than not, or whether that deal has expired or something like that. And so being able to track whether something is actively available and works for the thing that you're trying to buy is just not something that AI is contextually set up to do right now. So in a lot of the tests that we ran, we said, hey, find us the best deal on this flight from, New York to Burbank. The options that it gave back were quite manual. It still required having to go and actually look through to verify that that price was correct. And in several cases, it was not. And then the coupon codes that were found that would lower those prices were conditional on the kind of seats that you bought, which is something that AI was not aware of. So at the end of the day, it ended up being just about the same amount of work to use one of these tools than it was to just go and, look for the flights myself and choose one that was the most reasonably priced.
Do you know if legacy companies, I'm thinking of like Expedia or Travelocity, are they going to start using AI in their flight booking systems?
I'm sure that some level of AI is being used on those services when it comes to things like their chat assistants and things like that. But Google is one of the largest, flight tracking organizations right now, alongside, Expedia and some of the others. Google also makes the Gemini AI platform that is supposed to, make your life a little easier to do things that are exactly like this. And the results as they stand right now are just not what most of us who have been doing these tests would consider particularly useful.
And travel agents, are essentially a thing of the past. But do you see them coming back in the form of AI with people not wanting to plan the trip for themselves? Or if AI is making it more complicated, I guess you can have AI do it, or you can get a travel agent, another person to do it for you.
Yeah, I actually think it's entirely possible that human travel agents will be at least temporarily the answer to this problem, because being able to sort through all of that information and identify things that are, kind of working correctly and not working correctly, it's going to be quite a while before AI is able to do some of that deductive reasoning on a scale that applies to everyone and not just, the things that are pretty easy to find. So I think having, someone who is able to use those AI tools to gather, all of the things that are currently available and then, kind of use either deductive reasoning or, kind of a legacy of experience to filter out the things that are not actually, on sale would be a pretty powerful position for one to be in.
Yeah. And I guess I shouldn't say travel agents are a thing of the past, because they're not. They've just kind of changed their name, because booking a week long trip to Disney World is very complicated. It involves waking up at 6 a.m. to book some things. And so you can hire someone to do all that for you. That's essentially a travel agent. I don't know. If AI can't figure out how to fly me from New York to Orlando easily, I can't imagine it's going to book me my Disney reservations.
That's exactly right. And with that includes, you know, giving things like your logins to AI, which not everyone is going to be super willing to do. You know, we're definitely in a position when it comes to, you know, some of the more popular, you know, kind of travel destinations really across the world, where having, you know, that level of personal experience is going to matter a whole lot more than, you know, the perceived ease of AI.
Yeah. So like for booking Disney World, you hire someone like Dana loves Disney and she does it all for you. And then if you say you want to plan a multi-city 14-day trip to Europe, that's very complicated and time consuming. There's people you can hire to do that. I wouldn't want to have AI do that for me yet. Do you think that it
will? No, and in fact,
go ahead.
We're in a really interesting position when it comes to things like travel, where one of the most useful resources to people when they're traveling is using things like TikTok and Instagram or YouTube Shorts, you know, where you can find someone who actually lives in the area who can show you visually what those recommendations are and being able to plan, you know, based on that. And you know, much like the booking agent that you just described, there are tons of people who have made it their business to show people how they can, you know, save on travel through these social platforms so that folks will reach out to them directly and have them book these trips.
Okay. Well, now with how fast AI is moving, though, are we, I don't know, 3 years away from AI being able to book my trip somewhere, or are we 3 months away?
I would say we're probably around 6 months away from there being very specific conditions under which AI is useful for travel, by which I mean if you only fly through one airline and you're going to a place that is quite popular and so, you know, there aren't a lot of, you know, kind of caveats and things to jump through, then I think that it's possible that within 6 months we'll see one of the travel sites like Expedia or something like that have a system up. But there's going to be quite a bit of fact checking that comes along with that. And you know, sure, if you only fly Delta and you're going to Orlando and you're staying within the Disney bubble, then, you know, it's possible that all these things would end up being cost effective. But if you deviate from that in any way, then it's likely not going to end up being in your best interest to use those tools just yet.
All right. I wanted to pivot and talk about Prime Days, because the 4-day savings event for Amazon Prime members is back. And now Prime Day is 4 days, not just 1 day. So what are we going to be on the lookout for Amazon Prime Days?
Yeah, so we've had, you know, kind of three different goals for this event so far. The first is to see, you know, what Amazon is doing differently by extending this event out 4 days, where this time last year, this event was only 2 days. And a lot of what we're seeing is just that the event is longer. You know, a lot of the things that were on sale became on sale this morning and will remain at that price until Friday. There doesn't seem to be any, you know, kind of giant secondary opportunities to go and shop on the 10th or the 11th, other than if the thing is still available, then you'll still be able to buy it at that lower price. The other thing that we're taking a look at is how those prices are impacted by tariffs. One of the biggest areas that we have seen this change has been televisions. Over the last couple months, we have seen television prices slowly increase, and it was speculated that this was maybe not tariff related, but was the result of, you know, understanding that this big shopping event was coming up, and so you slowly increase the price so that you can drop it and say that it is on this significant discount. But even with the sales that are available now, there are quite a few televisions where the discount does not dip below what the price was back even in May. For a lot of those televisions. So my biggest recommendation to folks who are shopping for large purchases over this season is to take a look at tools like Camel, which I've recommended before, where you can take that Amazon link and you can drop it in and it will tell you what the history of that price was. So you can look back 3 months and see if it was, you know, if it was actually cheaper 3 months ago, then maybe now's not the right time to buy that particular thing. The other thing to keep in mind is that while, you know, Amazon is the one doing all the marketing with this thing at Prime Day, that there are really great sales that are also happening at Walmart and Best Buy. Best Buy's is called the Black Friday and July sale, and Walmart has had their, you know, great big announcements for their sales going on for quite some time. And we've seen things, especially when it comes to televisions and appliances and things like that, are often less expensive at Walmart and Best Buy than they are at Amazon right now.
Now, that price tracker you mentioned it before, Camel. Remind me, is it Camel, like, spelled like the animal?
That's right. Yep. Okay. And just 3 times and then .com.
Okay, got it. I want to check on some things. Are we expecting the Prime Day, if you buy it today, is it going to be cheaper on day 3 or day 4? Will prices change? We don't know that.
We're not going to have any of that, until the day comes, but Amazon has almost never done that for their shopping events in the past. And if they have, it has really just been that the sale had gone on and it was very popular. So the retailer decided, the creator of that product decided that that sale was no longer valid. So the price actually increased in the middle of the event and not decreased. So in a lot of cases, it ends up being that if, the vendor has a particular threshold for how many of these things that they want to sell. And once they reach that, then the sale price just goes back up to its standard price.
Is there anything you've been waiting to buy because you were waiting to see what it costs today?
Actually, the one, especially because of the heat here in Maryland this week, has been fans that have misting things built into them, so you can plug a little water thing into them and enjoy the outside a little more. Several of those are almost half off this week, and that is, I think, the one big purchase that I have made so far because I really miss sitting on my back patio, but the weather is not making it easy.
And do you know how urgent people need to be? Do you think things will go out of stock?
It's really hard to tell for this sort of thing. A lot of the things that are quite popular, at any point in the year remain popular here. So things like AirPods are on pretty great, discounts, but those are the kind of things that, Apple very rarely runs out of those kind of things. I think the stuff that ends up, if you're really concerned about a thing, selling out, my biggest piece of advice there would be to, check the best sellers tab on Amazon for stuff that is doing particularly well. And if any of those things apply to you, then I would, go, sooner rather than later. And then, CNET obviously maintains a pretty constant list of stuff that we have found that is of interest on sale. But that's kind of a rotating list based on things that we found that are actually at that discounted price and not what Amazon claims is the lowest price for it.
This is Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Russell Hawley, the Director of Commerce Content for CNET. Apple and Google are both working to improve their in-car experience for customers, and Apple has introduced its new Apple CarPlay Ultra. What is Ultra about this new version of Apple CarPlay?
So what this really comes down to is it's there are, by the time we get to around this time next year, there will essentially be two tiers of phone connected experience inside of a car. There'll be what you have right now. If you have a car that allows you to plug your phone in or wirelessly connect your phone and have access to your calls and your music and podcasts and things like that, that experience, if you own a car that does that right now, will almost assuredly remain exactly the same. Moving into the next couple of months, new cars that are made that either have worked out an agreement with Google directly for the thing that Google is calling Google Built-In, where the entertainment center in the car actually has Android running directly on it and can access all of your tools, or Apple's approach, which is to have a more capable processor built into the car that can handle requests that come from your phone when you are inside of the car. Those are not going to be available to everyone. They're going to be available through very specific partnerships, or if your car can meet the hardware requirements, it is weird that you're going to have to check and see what processor your car has to know whether your phone is going to be able to do these more advanced things. But that is essentially what's going to happen around this time next year. And what you're going to see is just a deeper level of control of the things in your car. If you want to control the temperature inside of your car, if you want to adjust any of the settings within things like that thing in your car does, where it like starts and turns off the engine when you're at a stop sign or something like that, you'll be able to control that with your voice effectively through a lot of these tools. It's just something that a lot of folks have said, hey, this experience that I get with my car is really great, but I wish it did more. This is an effort to solve that, but it is computationally kind of expensive. And so we're going to have this weird period in between where not everything's going to be the same when you get in a different car.
And so in the future, if you're going to buy a new car, if you're an Apple person or an Android person, are you going to have to check, or is this going to be exclusive to like a Honda or a Subaru or whatever, that it only runs one type of phone?
No, they'll end up doing both. It's just at what level you'll have control over certain things in your car. So you'll always, if you, you know, if a car has a car company has partnered with Apple and has not partnered with Google, it'll still run what is effectively Android Auto, the name of that platform, when you plug your phone in. It just likely won't do all of the things like controlling your air conditioner with your voice and things like that. That we may run into cars next year that only do that if you have an iPhone or only do that if you have an Android phone.
All right. Well, is this going to turn into a battleground where different car companies are going to try to have the Google built-in versus the Apple CarPlay Ultra?
Yes, that is essentially what's going to happen is, you know, Google and Apple are going to try and make as many of these, you know, kind of exclusive deals with these companies as possible in order to, you know, sway one or the other. But, you know, what we're talking about there is, you know, very, very high-end expensive cars are going to be the first cars that you see with some of this built in. The testing that we were able to do on this up until this point was a, you know, $250,000 Aston Martin. So not a car that everyone's going to see every day that has access to these features at the moment. But within a year, within, you know, within 6 months, I'm sure we'll see quite a few more with that built in.
Thank you for your time. That was Russell Hawley, the Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And this has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.